Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com.
Hey, Craig, how's it going?
Oh, you know, a little of this, a little of that. How about you?
Well, good. So it's been 14 years since we last recorded a podcast. And coincidentally, it's also been 14 years since The Incredibles by Brad Bird and Pixar. And here we are with Incredibles 2.
Well, how many podcasts have we attempted to record and not finished or not posted in those 14 years? About 500,000?
Yeah. Film Nerds Unlimited started in 2004, and we just kind of haven't done anything with it since then.
Yeah.
Well, we did that Tomorrowland episode, but nobody liked it, so that's why we're doing this one.
Oh, at least they heard it.
Right, exactly. So Incredibles 2. Are you a fan of the original?
Yes.
Yeah, I think everybody on the planet Earth is. What was your anticipation level for this?
Well, I should say, I did really enjoy it. It was the first, I think it was the first movie I saw at the Cobb Theater in Tuscaloosa. So, as you said, that was 04. And there was a problem with the projector, I think. Right around, like, the time the final fight on the island.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, but I did really enjoy it. It was definitely something new for Pixar. Sort of a new kind of completely new avenue to go down. And so for the last several years, my daughter who just turned 5, she'll go back to Incredibles every few months and watch it for, you know, over and over for a few days. And so to answer your question on my anticipation level, it's a couple of different schools of thought. One is, oh, great, another thing my daughter can watch over and over and over and over again. And two, it's, oh, good, something else my daughter can watch over and over again. It's not the other thing that she watches over and over again. So, you know,
yeah,
right? I was excited because I was interested to see which way they would go with it. There's all kinds of options they could have taken. And, you know, it was wide open, but they could have stayed close to home, you know, which they kind of did in the beginning. What about you? What did you think?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I mean, it's funny. I wasn't prepared to reminisce, but I remember pretty distinctly going to Firehouse Subs in Tuscaloosa, I think right after seeing The Incredibles at the Cobb. I remember thinking it had a lot of potential, and seeing that first teaser trailer that used the John Barry score from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and thinking, wow, this looks interesting, and I like the Iron Giant a lot, and it's that guy. And then seeing it and just being like, holy crap, like, this is not Toy Story or Finding Nemo. Like, this is pretty close to an adult superhero movie. And then it's just one of those movies that every time I watch it, it gets better and better. And it just felt different and special in 2004, even for, like you said, even for among Pixar movies, which were usually special and different among animation movies, this stood out as something that was just going for something completely different that movies just didn't go for very often. It's not a problem with Incredibles 2, but one of my major takeaways is that now we live in a world where they do this a lot. You know, we have computer-generated action, superhero action scenes every other weekend at the movie theater, you know? So we have even the plot of the original Incredibles and somewhat this one of, like, superheroes aren't wanted and they, you know, they need to be regulated.
Right.
That has become such a trope in movies from Batman versus Superman, the original X-Men movie, obviously Captain America Civil War. It's just like this idea of superhero collateral damage is, I feel like we have explored that idea to death. So I feel like if this movie had come out in 2006, that theme would have been a little bit more interesting, a little bit more cogent. But now it's kind of feels a little bit behind the times. But I think what's not behind the times are the themes in this film about why we enjoy superhero movies and if it's necessary, and the religious aspects of feeling like we need protection from ourselves and protection from the world and what that affords us, if that makes us lazy. There's a interesting debate in this children's movie between two female characters about, you know, the difference in worldviews between believers and cynics. And there's an incredible action scene where Elastigirl is looking for a bad guy, and while she's doing that, the bad guy's voiceover is kind of like laying out this motivation, and it's super creepy and super effective and super fun to watch. And so, like, there's parts in the movie that are a little bit behind the eight ball and kind of feel a little bit outdated, but then there's other parts that feel very modern and very relevant and very exciting. So it's, I would say it's like 80-20 mixed bag of, like, and even the 20% isn't bad. You know, there's like nothing that's like crummy in this movie. It just doesn't feel nearly as fresh as anything in the first one.
Yeah, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the Civil War story arc, that event, that Marvel event, wasn't that written in 2005?
Yeah, 05, 06, I believe.
Okay,
yeah.
So even Incredible sort of predates that by a couple of years.
Right, and but of course, Incredibles is kind of a take on Watchmen.
So
20 years before.
Right, and so you, yeah, they did, you know, when you wait 14 years, you allow, that's a decade and a half, you know, you allow other studios, other forms of art to sort of take off on that platform, and you come back right to it, and you're right, it does feel, the whole, I mean, I was able to see past it, as I'm sure you were too, but it's a valid point. You have to be thinking, this is a sequel to a movie that came out 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's easy to do that because it picks up literally right where it left off, which is great.
But
in 20, 25 years from now, nobody's going to really, you know, the people watching this movie aren't going to really know that. But they're probably not going to be able to put, you know, coherent thoughts together like we are right now because they're going to be children. So,
I love that it picks up. It just occurs to me that you could make a top 10 favorite movies list of the subgenre of federal superhero regulation movies.
Right. There's your Letterboxd list.
Yeah, that could be it. Yeah, exactly. I love that it picks up, and I kind of like that the Underminer is left unresolved, which makes me think that combined with a $180 million opening weekend, I'm thinking that we're going to get Incredibles 3, and I'm hoping that Underminer comes back again, you know, and he's the one that got away. I can't help but think that that's kind of the plan. And also because this movie ties up the loose ends of the illegality of superheroes from the first film, I think that the next film is almost like, it almost feels like a transition movie, you know, where it's like the first one is about superheroes are illegal, and this one is about superheroes are about to not be illegal anymore. And the third one is going to be the superhero family. You know, it's going to be Fantastic Four, and like everybody is aware of them, and they have, you know, they're out in the open. And I think that's interesting. I think that's, I don't know, like part of me is like, well, what if you had just kind of rushed through that in the first act of this movie and then gotten to
right.
that. But I don't know. There are enough small things and small character arcs in this movie to totally justify it. You know, that I don't need it to be the end all be all epic standalone Incredibles movie. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, you know, and it ends with, if I'm not mistaken, it ends with Dicker kind of telling them,
or maybe it wasn't him, maybe it was somebody else, one of his colleagues or something, you know, we're going to take care of everything. They're reassured that everything's going to be okay because they did save a lot of, they saved the city from, you know, the bad guy.
Right.
And then it starts this movie and they don't save the Underminer, but it's like literally about face. It's like, you know, hey, you know, you guys suck. There was no, like, there was no support at all. Like they were kind of told at the end of the first one they were going to get. And they never would have donned their superhero attire and tried to save that
yeah.
part of the city from the Underminer had they not been reassured that everything was going to be okay at the end of the first one. So it's literally like a matter of days or something when they go to that track meet, you know, and in the parking lot they see the Underminer come out. So it's kind of, I was kind of, when I watched the end of that and saw that, I was kind of like, well, I thought they had a little more support, but they kind of backtrack a little bit. They said, oh, no, we're insured. Don't worry. This whole bank just fell beneath the ground. But we're insured. It's okay. Like, that would have happened anyways
yeah.
had he not intervened, you know? So that part I was kind of like, okay, well, we have to reinstate, we have to establish again that superheroes are a big no-no, even though we did that in the first one. I think they wanted to double down and say, no, there's been no progress made. But they'd already kind of hinted that there would be at the end of the first one. So I'll stop.
Yeah.
Going down there.
Well, I mean, I can't take credit for noticing this. I heard it on the Flash Filmcast. But they mentioned that, you know, the first movie is about this mysterious billionaire courting Mr. Incredible and helping Mr. Incredible get back into the superhero world. And then, like, this movie, it takes place, like you said, presumably, like, 3 days later, and a mysterious billionaire comes along and tries to ask a girl back in on the superhero game. It's like, didn't you guys just make this mistake? Not that it was really a mistake this time. So, I mean, I guess that's an inversion of what happened in the first movie, but it seems like they maybe should have mentioned that. Like, Mr. Kedlick would have been like, I don't trust this situation. But
yeah, good point.
Know.
Yeah.
Well, but and I think a lot of the movie is trying to kind of turn expectations upside down, you know, and that like the super enthusiastic fanboy, turns out to just be a super enthusiastic fanboy. You know, he's not this bitter villain that he was, that's a similar character was in the first one.
Yeah. And I don't want to harp too much on this because this is a children's movie, despite some reviews out there and what they've said, but it was so obvious who the villain was, and that's okay. I'm not complaining. I'm wondering, you know, why didn't they see that? You know, it's like the one that's kind of sitting off in the corner, kind of hunched over, you know, complaining or that's the one that's the bad guy. You know, that's the one you need to watch out for. But anyways,
I think I agree with that. Like the villain of the first movie is Syndrome, and the villain of the second movie is Evelyn Deaver. Evelyn. Like, it's just a lady named Evelyn. I mean, I know mm-hmm. that, like, the screenslaver is kind of like the cover, but after that character is uncovered, which, by the way, everything about the screenslaver and everything that has to do with that character in this movie is awesome.
Awesome.
But yeah, as soon as she's revealed, which you're right, it's like, yeah, I kind of saw it coming. It just kind of fell flat. Like the action was still good, but there was something I kept waiting. I don't know. There was something throughout the whole film. I kept waiting for the next, like something in the plot to knock my socks off.
Yeah,
obviously, the action was knocking my socks off. I mean, there's stuff in it. The strobe, I mentioned the kind of voiceover section earlier, but there's a fight right after that that takes place in the strobe room that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
The motorcycle stuff is awesome. It's just like them fighting the other super team, the Crusher, Crushower, whatever his name is, where he's like, you want me to uncrush? That was kind of one of the moments of the movie for me. So all of that stuff was great, but the plot, I felt like I kept waiting for some sort of something to click, and it just kind of kept rolling along the way that I was expecting it to.
Well, I, what I kind of bugs me is that they introduce these new supers, and they immediately, next time you see them, they're zombies, and they're slaves for the villain. They're doing the villain's bidding, and I don't want the first time I see them in action to be against them. And then they immediately do the same very easily to Elastigirl and Mr. Incredible. Mm-hmm. And that kind of bug, that stuff like that in any movie kind of bugs me, to where it's just like, I don't want anybody working against each other. I want them working together. That's just a pet peeve of mine.
So you're not a fan of Temple of Doom? When Indy turned teal.
That was just a little moment. And I'm hoping we can talk more about that very soon.
Never.
This recording app works. But it's like, well, to your point earlier, the Frozone action, that's his name, right? The ice
yeah.
guy?
Yeah.
His scenes were awesome. And looking back on the first movie, they were really cool too, but he was able to do, he was showcased more in this movie. I think he was really cool to watch. I think any future movie, obviously you got to have him like very much involved, and they did very well while putting him involved, even like coming over to babysit the kids. But I'm glad they kind of relatively, they pretty easily and quickly had the good guys sort of play bad for a while, and almost just as easily, with the parents at least, turn them back.
Yeah.
Took off the glasses. And that to me was like, I want to see you fight the bad guys, not the good guys.
But there are no by the bad guys. Yeah, that's the thing, is there are no bad guys in this movie. It's just one person that can control the good guys. And again, it's this thing that it would have maybe felt fresh if we hadn't seen it in Avengers with Hawkeye, or in Justice League with Superman, or in X-Men with Cyclops and everybody in X2. It's just, it just kind of feels like a trope at this point. And that's, again, the unfortunate byproduct of making a superhero movie when everybody makes superhero movies. I feel this weird guilt where I'm like, there's these things that, you know, were kind of sticking with me in the movie, like kind of like keeping me at distance. But then on the other side, it's like, well, who am I to complain about a Brad Bird-directed superhero movie, you know, in 2018, like, which is as awesome as it sounds. Like, there's that part of it is great. It's overall, I kind of have to keep coming back to it. It was a great time. And it was also my daughter's first trip to the movie theater, which was a pretty resounding success. There were only a few scary moments where she kind of had to hide her eyes, including that screen flavor strobe room fight, which is intense. It was really satisfying. And I guess it's funny that we've gone all this way without talking about the raccoon fight, which is another highlight of the movie.
Yeah, the Jack and the raccoon fight was a big hit in our theater. He cracked a lot of people up. There was a lot of funny moments there. I think that's probably one of the best parts of the film, because that kid probably has more power than his whole rest of his family put together. I really thought the Elastigirl on a bike scene with the train, and also her, as you said, trying to find the screen slavers later. That stuff was really good. I think everybody's kind of showcased pretty well by now, including with the first movie and the second movie. I think they kind of rounded everybody out, so you can see what everybody can do. But with the Jack thing, I was unsure about this, but I guess they made it clear with the second movie is that they did not see him use his powers at the end of the first movie, which kind of makes sense because he's up in the air. But we all see it very clearly. I just had kind of always assumed they saw it too.
Well, she says like, what's going on up there? I noticed
right.
that like when we watched the movie again the other day.
Yeah, and still, after I've seen the second one, going back and watching the first one, she says, what's going on up there? And they don't really say anything else about it, except she just goes up there to try and save them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fine. It's practically airtight. It was just, you know, over 14 years, I guess. I assumed, oh, that family has moved on, and now they know their child has powers. But as we said earlier, just a few days have gone by, and they do realize that he has powers because of the damage that he did to the yard trying to kill the raccoon. which was a really good moment. As I said, you know, you look at the raccoon's face and it looks like a bad guy's, you know, mask. So he kind of
put two together
and
it also looks like the family because they wear the same mask.
Right, but I think they were trying to connect it to
sort of bandit,
right?
And he didn't want to, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, but overall, I liked it. It's probably kind of like, you know, mid-range Pixar, maybe on the higher end of the mid-range for me. What about you?
Oh, you know, I actually haven't gone back to, think about that. I need to go check out my Letterboxd, but I think, that's a good question. Probably going to be, now I got to think about all of them. Yeah, probably top of the mid-range, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like right there with Finding Dory for me, where it's like a really, 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 really good sequel by a guy who had a really bad live-action flop.
Now, did he do Mission Impossible before that?
Yeah, he did Incredibles, and then he did Ratatouille, and then Mission Impossible, and then Tomorrowland.
So he only did my favorite Pixar, and then the fourth Mission Impossible?
Right.
So he did my favorite Pixar, and arguably the best Mission Impossible, especially after this far into the franchise, you know, decades in. So where did he lose his touch? Why does he suck? I don't know.
Well, he's just never going to be a master.
Yeah.
No, I think Tomorrowland seemed like a miscalculation. The script was troubled, and it was very expensive, so it had a lot of fingers on it. I think that he just got caught up in the Hollywood machine. That movie has some really awesome parts in it. But, you know, on the script level, it's bizarre in a lot of places and messy in a lot of places. So, I mean, I feel like he did his job, but then it was a huge flop. So this is definitely kind of a reclamation project for Brad Bird. And I think that you can tell this movie plays a lot. He took a lot of risks in Tomorrowland. This movie takes not too many risks. It takes some, and that's cool. But it definitely feels like the work of a guy that's like, all right, I'm cracking my knuckles. I'm going to get to work giving the audience exactly what I think they want. And I'm not going to let myself get in the way. And that's admirable. I'm hoping he does another live action before he does Incredibles 3. I don't see why he wouldn't. I think that this was a way to stay out of director's jail. And I think he succeeded because it's going to make a ton of money. It already has.
2032, The Incredibles 3.
Yeah, why not?
Hey, when you make Incredibles 3, do you have everybody be the same age, or do you make Jack-Jack be bigger?
Like
older?
A teenager?
Yeah, or maybe Dash's age, just to where, because he could conceivably be more powerful than anybody else in his family.
Maybe he's the villain.
Do.
Maybe he's the villain next time.
He's the villain.
Yeah, he's the black sheep. That's his super villain name. And they're all old.
And he's being controlled, right. They're all in nursing homes and insane asylums.
Yeah. Well, yeah, well, they have grandkids, you know. Dash is like, is on his like third wife.
This could be good. But see, what you do is you lose the baby stuff. Because it's him as a baby, that's what everybody likes. It's funny. You know?
It is funny, and I feel like it was way funnier in this than I was expecting it to be. It was such a crux of the short that was, you know, came out of the first movie and such a big crux of the marketing for this. I was like, got it, baby is funny. I get it. And then in the movie, it's like, oh, no, this is great. I love this. So I kind of hope they don't lean on it anymore. But I kind of like the idea that it just picks up right after this one, and they just keep doing that because they can, because it's computer animated. I like that idea.
There's a whole package at Target that's just like every iteration of Jack-Jack in one thing.
Yeah.
There's like four or five Jack-Jacks. There's like the metal one, the fire one, the... Oh, I don't
Demon.
Know. Yeah. Yes, the demon and the regular one, and then the one in the suit and the one in the diaper.
Yeah, that's a lot of money that they're throwing away if they don't put Jack-Jack in the third one.
Yeah, maybe they just decide, you know, they could put him up for adoption.
It's like L'Enfant with Jack-Jack.
What do you think of the language in this one?
It's a little for older audiences,
isn't it?
They say hell and damn.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah,
and they say God, which usually Disney movies.
They say, oh, my God, several times. I think that's like several people's reaction to Jack-Jack is to say, oh, my God.
Yeah, and you should put gosh in there or something.
Or Jesus tap dancing Christ. Why not that, you know?
Right. I just wonder if that was like, if they're trying to make this edgier.
Yeah, I think so. You know? I mean, I remember the original one was like kind of shocking because it like, you know, it suggested that Mr. and Mrs. Incredible, you know, had a sex life. So I think that this is, they're trying to get a little bit of edge. This is the adult Pixar franchise.
Yeah. And I think the style kind of fits that with it. Just the kind of art deco kind of, Dick Tracy, you know, like seems to always be sunset, you know, or night, you know.
Oh God, I love that. The design of like the way they integrated the Disney logo at the beginning, immediately, I was like,
in the castle. Like, I love how they do that with the castle in the beginning.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So awesome.
Yeah. It's because they did that with Beauty and the Beast, the live action, which I thought was pretty cool. And then this one was also, and right when they started doing it, I was like, yeah, this looks awesome. They're doing that little thing where they change the castle and stuff. But
yep.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, all the design, all the music, everything is just exquisite. All right, well, see you in 14 years.
All righty.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.